Up next, from the Center for Social Innovation, Ashkan Jafari conducts an exclusive interview with Dr. Mohamed Yunus, the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize winner. Dr. Yunus shares his compelling story about founding Grameen Bank, his vision for the social business movement, and talks about what drives him to wake up every day to tackle the world's toughest problems.
On Social Innovation Conversations.
Hi, I'm Chris Deigelmeyer, the Executive Director of the Center for Social Innovation.
And I'm Eric Nee, the Managing Editor of the Stanford Social Innovation Review.
Welcome to Social Innovation Conversations. Today, we're excited to bring you another interview in the Social Innovation Live series.
This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Social Innovation, a department of the Stanford Graduate School of Business that educates leaders to solve the world's toughest social and environmental problems.
And now, here is Ashkan.
Hello, this is your host, Ashkan Jafari. Today, our guest is Dr. Mohamed Yunus, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, founder of Grameen Bank, pioneer of the social business movement, and author. His new book is called Building Social Business, the New Kind of Capitalism that Serves Humanity's Most Pressing Needs. Dr. Yunus, thanks so much for being on our show today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
To start off, Dr. Yunus, can you please tell us a little bit about yourself and how Grameen Bank was first started?
Well, I started my career as a professor. I used to teach in a college here in Bangladesh. Then I went out in the U.S. on a Fulbright scholarship and finished my Ph.D. in teaching in a university there, Middle Tennessee State University in Nashville, Tennessee. Then after the War of Liberation began in Bangladesh, at the end of it, I came back to Bangladesh and started teaching in the university. And then I saw the problem of poverty, and I got involved with it and get involved with lending money to the poor people in a village next door to the university because of the problem of loan sharks in that village. So I thought I can do it by lending money from my own pocket. Then I thought I should connect them with the banks. They should be lending money. But the banks said they cannot do that. They are not supposed to lend money to the poor people. They only lend money to people who are already well off. So I thought that's a very strange thing to do because money should go to the people who don't have the money rather than money going to the people who already have a lot of money. So I tried to convince them, but they were not convinced. So finally, I offered myself as a guarantor and took the money from the bank and gave it to the people in the village, and it worked, and it became known as microcredit, and it spread all over the world.
And what are some of the specific challenges Grameen Bank has faced, and what lessons have you or others learned from those challenges?
Well, there are lots of challenges. When you do something for the first time, which people always believe that cannot be done, it's very difficult to convince people that what's happening is real. They always thought, oh, it can happen in one village, that you'll never be able to do it in two villages. Then you do it in two villages. They say, maybe two villages is possible, but five villages will not be possible. The whole thing will collapse. So they're always waiting for us to collapse. And in the meantime, we continued our work from village to village, expanded. So this is one problem of mindset. People don't want to change their mindset. And there was a religious opposition because we are lending money to women. Religious leaders thought this is wrong because this will allow women to get out of the houses and be out in the open. And they thought they shouldn't do that. They should stay home and take care of the children. This is the traditional village kind of religious feeling that women should stay home. And we are challenging that. So that became a big problem for us and for them to see that it's happening. So that became our first confrontation. Another problem came at the side by side with that. We were focusing on women. So men were very upset. Men thought we were insulting them. We were challenging their authority within the family. We said, no, we are not doing anything. We are simply helping everybody to get involved in earning money for the family. So it's helpful for everybody, for the whole family. But it's very difficult when you are dealing with the traditional family where man is the master of the family and woman is kind of a person who will take orders from the man. and now women are getting money. And he felt very humiliated that why should a woman have the money directly? If woman has to have money, it should come through me, the man. So that became another big problem. And also we had problems with the religious, not only religious, political leaders. The extreme left thought we are the agents of the capitalist system. We are trying to bring capitalism at the grassroots, at the villages, so that they will not rise in the socialist revolution anymore. They will be happy with little money and then continue with their life with this little money without expecting any big change in the society. And extreme right thought we are just a front runner for the Communist Party. So all we are doing is mobilizing the poor people in the name of giving loans. Someday they will take over the whole country. So everybody was suspicious. So all these things came at the same time. Lessons would be like cultural difficulties. And we kept saying that, look, we know the culture of Bangladesh and the village culture of Bangladesh, but we are creating a counterculture. Culture should always be accompanied by counterculture. Culture is something to grow with people. Culture is not something rigid, something frozen. Any rigid culture is a dead culture. I said the place for dead culture is the museum, not in human society. Human society is a part of a living culture. It grows, it expresses itself in many different ways. So you need a counterculture attached to the culture all the time. But they will not accept that. They said, no, this is our tradition, this is our culture, this is the way we live. I said, well, if we had respected that kind of culture, then we should be in the caves, because that's where we used to be. So let's go back to the caves. Why are we here? We violated the culture of caves. So all kinds of arguments we gave. But finally, people saw that it made sense to take money and earning income. And we continued with that. And even the religious people came around saying that it's happening and people are benefiting and women are becoming confident and there's nothing they can do about it. And we gave examples from the religion again, saying that religion never opposed women being in business. Even the wife of the Prophet Muhammad was a businesswoman herself, so nobody could dispute that. So we bring this up. So it takes a lot of time and a lot of energy to make people accept the way you do things.
And after all of these challenges, can you talk about where Grameen Bank is today?
Well, we are a nationwide bank for a long time now. We started in one village. Now, literally, we work in all the villages of Bangladesh, which is over 80,000 villages. And we have over 8 million borrowers. 97% of them are women, extremely poor women, when they joined Grameen Bank. And gradually, they improve their life and go up the ladder step by step because they take this loan and start earning income for themselves. And we encourage them to send their children to school so that they can have education, because these women, all these 8 million borrowers that we have in Grameen Bank, are literally illiterate. They don't know how to read and write. But we wanted to make sure their children don't follow the same path. Their children become a different kind of generation from their generation. So we made sure that all the children are at school, and we succeeded in that. And then we started giving education loans for sending them to colleges and universities for higher education. So we have thousands and thousands of students now, near about 52,000 students who are in medical schools, engineering schools, universities. So you have a completely different second generation than we had in the first generation, who are our borrowers. Their children are well-educated. We are encouraging them to get involved in enterprises. We said you should have a pledge when you think about your future. Don't think in a traditional way. Your pledge should go something like this. I'm not going to be a job seeker. I'm a job giver. So I'll not apply for a job from anybody. What I'll do, my mission in life is to create job for others. And that's what I'm going to do. I'll use my education, my skill, my creativity to create enterprises so that other kids can come and work for me. So that's where the traditional thought that if you go to school, if you go to higher education, all you do is to find a job. So that way people get very frustrated. Where am I going to get a job? So we kind of changed that mindset. No, why should I find a job? I create jobs because my mother owns a bank, meaning that the Grameen Bank is owned by his mother because this bank is owned by the borrowers themselves. So that means all those 8 million borrowers, they own this bank, and their children can look at this bank as a bank which is owned by their mothers. So their mother's bank have plenty of money. So why should I go and apply for jobs and get frustrated because of the rejection and so on? Why don't I just go ahead and start an enterprise myself and hire people to work for me? So this is another way we are trying to build it up and so on. So we encourage them to start savings program, the borrowers. So they have a huge amount of savings, nearly $500 million in savings they have in the bank. Bank lends out over $100 million a month, and then they pay back with near perfect repayment, 97%, 98% repayment account. So this is what the Grameen Bank is all about.
And how did the field of microfinance fare in the global financial crisis? How was it affected, if at all? And what does it tell us about the future of the world's financial fabric?
Grameen Bank was not impacted by the global financial crisis because Grameen Bank and microcredit is very close to the real economy. When we give a $100 loan or $200 loan, against that loan, there's a business, there's a cow, there's some chickens. So it's a one-to-one correspondence between the real economy and the credit that we give. So in that kind of banking, you can't go wrong because you are connected with the real situation. The financial crisis came because conventional bankers were chasing profit and they were becoming extra risk takers and became gamblers in the process. So they converted the marketplace, as the newspapers always reported us, they converted the marketplace as a kind of gambling casino. So they were betting on making more money and more money. And they had no connection with the real economy. They just paper. They were chasing papers. They don't know what these papers are, what these papers represented. Because when a banker lends money, waits for the borrower to pay back, that's a traditional way. But now banks don't wait for the borrower to pay back. They just sell the paper. Then somebody pays back the money and buys the paper, and he sells the paper again to somebody else. So finally, we don't know what this paper is, who's the borrower, the lender-borrower relationship completely got snapped. And it's a speculative thing. We have this many papers, and we are buying this, selling this, and we are betting that this will make us rich. So let's pay a lot more money than they deserve. And that's where building castles in the air begins, and that's where it collapses. Because it becomes artificial.
Your new book, Building a Social Business, discusses your most recent work with the Grameen organizations. Can you discuss this transition from Grameen Bank to supplementing it with the Grameen companies?
No, this is not about supplementing in that sense that this is not connected. The companies that we build, which we have been doing for a long time, as we build Grameen Bank. Very soon we started building other companies. Some are related to agriculture, some are related to fisheries, some are related to internet providers, some are related to mobile phones and so on. So we have nearly 40 such companies built. And the special thing about these companies which I built, I don't own any one of them. I don't own any single share of them because I built them to solve problems. Whenever I see a problem, I go ahead and design a business to solve the problem. So I always try to solve any social problem by creating a business for the sake of solving the problem rather than making money. Then I realized that this is one kind of business which is missing in the whole economic theory, because in economic theory, they are telling us that all businesses should be designed to maximize profit. Business means making money. I said, no, business means solving problems. So we can have two different kinds of businesses. One business to make money, one business to solve problems. Because I keep saying that conventional economic thinking assumes all human beings are very selfish. All they do is to change their life, make a lot of money, be wealthy. It's all concentrated on the self. I said, that's a very narrow understanding of human being. Human beings are not one-dimensional human being. Well, human being is multidimensional. Human beings want to do many different kinds of things. Like human beings are selfish, at the same time human beings are selfless. But economics doesn't have any room for selfless being. So I said, you destroy the whole idea or whole essence of human being. So as a result, we created all this problem because we created the selfish human beings in our business world, in our economic world. We can solve all this problem if we have admitted that people have many different ideas, many different dimensions, selfless dimensions and as well as selfish dimensions. So I'm talking about creating a business on the basis of our selflessness, where we do business to solve other people's problem. And there's no interest in personally benefiting from the business by the investor himself. And this is the class of business I'm talking about as a social business. So I started creating those social businesses, some to eliminate the malnutrition, some business created to bring drinking water in the villages because villages don't have clean drinking water. We have a problem of arsenic in the villages. So how to address the problem of arsenic in water? How to bring clean water in a business way. Not a business way in the sense we want to make money out of it. Simply, business way means we want to bring water in such a way we cover the cost so that it keeps running. Once you create a social business, unlike charity, it doesn't close down because you have enough resources within the business which will keep it going and keep on cycling. It keeps recycling over and over again. So this is what we have been talking about. And that's the essence of the book that I wrote, which is called Building Social Business.
So can you talk about the social business partnership with Danone?
Yeah, this is one of those social businesses that we built. This is a collaboration, a joint venture between Danone and Grameen. We call it Grameen Danone Company. With this joint venture, what we do, we produce yogurt. And it's a social business. So the whole idea of creating this business is not to make money out of it, but to solve a problem. In this case, the problem is malnutrition. Bangladesh has a serious problem of nutrition among the children. Nearly 50% or half of the children of Bangladesh are malnourished. So what we have done, we created a special kind of yogurt filled with all the micronutrients which are missing in the children. So this is an enriched yogurt. If a child eats 2 cups of this yogurt within a week and repeats this every week for, say, 8 months or 9 months, the child is supposed to receive all the micronutrients which are missing in the body. So child becomes a healthy child. And you can see the difference, see the growth of the nutrition in the child as we go through these 8 and 9 months. It's not just you have to wait until the 8 months and suddenly you see healthy. No. As you do that, as the child eats this yogurt, and you can see the child becoming more playful, becoming more active, and getting healthier, weight is increasing, and that sort of thing. So we are selling this yogurt, made it very cheap, selling it to the poor children, malnourished children, and in a business way, meaning that it should recover the cost. And we've done a very good job. And it's still our first plant that we made for Grameen Danone yogurt is already operating at the full capacity. So we are setting up the second plant and then getting prepared for the third plant because people are responding very positively to this yogurt.
Can you talk about some other partnerships that have been formed between Grameen organizations, Grameen companies, and Fortune 500 companies?
We have created a lot of companies now. One I just mentioned with Ganon, and there is another one that we have done with Veolia. Veolia is one of the topmost water company in the world, based in France. It's a multinational company. And this company that we built called Grameen Veolia Water Company, we set up a water treatment plant in the village of Bangladesh and produce clean, safe water and sell it in the village very cheap so that everybody can afford it. They don't have to drink the arsenic water. Almost half the population of Bangladesh drinks arsenic contaminated water and high level of arsenic. So their children are also drinking this arsenic contaminated water. So we thought we should find a solution to this, because when you drink arsenic contaminated water, lots of diseases get into your body, and cancers, and even causing deaths. So this is something we feel, people feel very helpless. There's nothing one can do. There's no other source of water. So they keep on drinking the same water. They know it's extremely dangerous for the health. So we are saying, no, we don't have to do that. We can produce water and sell water, and you drink this clean water. So this is the Grameen Veolia Water Company is doing. If this is successful, everything goes well, then we'll continue to expand this, create more and more water treatment plants all over Bangladesh so that everybody can drink clean water. Another company that we built is with the BASF, another very large chemical company based in Germany. What we do, we are in the process of producing mosquito nets. These are treated mosquito nets. Chemically treated mosquito nets. Once you use that, mosquitoes cannot come near you because it repels mosquitoes, and you remain safe, and you have a sound sleep. At the same time, you protect yourself from malaria and other mosquito-borne diseases like dengue and many other things. So this is again related to healthcare. This is a social business. BASF is not here to make money out of this. All we want to do, both Grameen and BASF, is to cover our cost and make sure everybody can afford to buy this mosquito net and use it and protect their children, protect their family from malaria and everything else. So this is an example of social business. And we have a social business with Adidas. The challenge that I gave to Adidas is nobody in the world should go without shoes. And as a shoe company, it's their responsibility to make sure everybody has, they produce shoes for everybody in an affordable way. So out of this challenge came a joint venture between Adidas and Grameen. We'll be producing Reebok brand name shoes, making it extremely cheap, as close to, hopefully as close to as €1, and then sell it in the villages. People who otherwise remain barefoot. If you remain barefoot, it attracts all kinds of diseases in your body. Many of the parasitic diseases enters the body through the skin of the feet. So if you're barefoot, all these parasites get into your body. And your stomach gets bloated, and your nutrition goes down, and you have all other problems because your stomach is filled with parasites. So this is one way to protect people from parasitic diseases by letting them wear shoes, comfortable shoes, good-looking shoes, and you enjoy wearing it, and it looks good, and it's a brand name and all that stuff. But going to the extremely poor children, extremely poor adults, and so on. So this is, again, a social business. So we have now another one with a Japanese company called Uniqlo. This is a textile company, one of the largest textile chain in Japan. They have outlets in Europe and other countries. So we have a now Grameen Uniqlo joint venture. And through this, we'll bring sanitary napkins for women in the villages who never use any sanitary napkins. Say, use dirty clothes and things of that sort and contact so many diseases and suffer through the whole life. So we said we can bring very clean sanitary napkins for sanitary underwear for the women in the villages in a very affordable way and a safe way so that they don't have to suffer through the way they have to suffer for ages and ages. So this would be one. And also producing warm clothing for winter. Many of the poor families don't afford to have warm clothing. They suffer a lot in winter because our winter can become quite severe in a warm country. Our weather, temperature goes down to nearly 6 degrees Celsius sometimes in winter. So it gets quite cold, and children die of cold because there is no warm place anywhere and there's no warm clothing. Old people die sometimes. So we said we can produce this warm clothing, make it very cheap, very affordable, so that everybody can afford that. So this is, there is a series of these things now happening one after another. And we enjoy doing that, and we're talking about producing solar panels because we have Gramin Shakti, or Gramin Energy Company. We sell solar home system as a social business. We sell over 1,000 solar home system per day right now, and it's increasing. People are responding very well. So we need to have solar panels produced in the country and also battery so that we can do it in a social business way. It doesn't get add up any extra cost in that. So that renewable energy becomes part of our life everywhere in Bangladesh. And we also introduce, through social business, improved cooking stove so that you save fuel woods because we are chopping up trees every day. By chopping up trees to cook our meals, it's not necessary. With improved design that we are promoting, 50% of the need of the fuel wood is reduced, and it becomes more safe, healthy. You don't have to have respiratory diseases because you're smoking, breathing smoke all the time, inhaling smoke all the time. So this is not necessary if you do the improved cooking stove with a chimney and all the smoke goes out through the roof rather than smoking up the whole house. So this is also just, we are getting very good response from them. So we have all kinds of things in the move, and we are very happy with that.
Your book also discusses other players and institutions in the social business arena, such as research institutions, think tanks, and eventually stock markets. Can you talk more about these other groups?
Yeah, what we have been talking about, once you accept the fact that we can create a world with two businesses, not one business, and both businesses will be working side by side. So today we have only one business in the world, the business of making money. So we built institutions for those one kind of business that we have. We have rating agencies, we have brokers, we have the stock exchange, we have banking for that, we have funds, investment funds for that, there's hedge funds for that. Everything that you know about business is there only to serve one purpose, strengthening the business to make money. So when you introduce a second business, you need to create everything that you have created for the other kind of business, because the same institution will not work for that. So you need to create another kind of funds where you can go if you have an idea of social business. You need the money. So you go to the social business fund. And social business fund is also a social business. So they are not going to make money out of you. They want to participate with you because they believe in the same objective that you have. You want to solve the problem of water, you want to solve the problem of malnutrition, solve the problem of environment. So they want to invest in you, not for money, but for the solving the problem, because social business is a problem-solving business. When you are designing a business to solve the problem, you are designing the business not for making money. So that's not the intention. To make it clear, social businesses themselves make money. They make profit. But owners have decided they will not take any profit. So it's not a question of these companies don't make money at all. No, they make money because they need the money for expansion. They need the money for improvement. But the idea is investors are not interested in getting the money back. The money is plowed back into the business to continue and so on. So we need the stock market where you can list all the social businesses. So it will be a social stock market. So if you want to make an impact in people's life, you come to this stock market and try to look for the company that you would like, whether they are working for the safety of the children, whether they are looking for health care for the mother, or the company is working for the taking care of the old people, or there's a company who is taking care of the drug addicts to bring out from the drugs as a social business. So you have a variety of investment opportunities, and you decide to put your $1,000 in one of those companies that you like and buy share from that company. So you need that space, the stock market, where you can go and do that kind of thing. So this is a stock market idea, and you need to think tank to think about the impact that businesses are making, how to improve that, to let people know what's coming up, what is the next big challenging task we do, and design social businesses, and also design courses for the universities and degrees for the universities. Today, if you go to business school, they give you a degree called MBA, Masters of Business Administration, and they teach you how to join a company and make sure the company makes a lot of money for their shareholders. That's the only thing they teach you, because that's what the purpose of this MBA. You become an expert in helping the company grow, make more money for their shareholders. But if I'm having a social business, I don't need that skill because I'm not interested in making money. So MBAs will be irrelevant for the training they got. It's not as useful for social business. So I said, why don't the universities open up another department or another school of business where they give you a degree of social MBAs? You are taught how to design a social business, how to make big impact in the society, how to change the society, how to solve the problems of the society, how to run a business, how to measure impact, and all those sort of things. So that you are prepared. When you are out, you can go out in a social business and immediately take over and start doing the things that you have learned. You don't have to spend time to learn what is a social business and all that. So in every stage, in that you have to write new textbooks where it will be explained there are two kinds of businesses in the world. One business is for you to make money for yourself, improve your financial position, and another business to make impact in other people's lives by solving problems, problems that you don't want to see around you, and you can do that in a business way. So you start thinking as a child when you're reading these textbooks that when you grow up, you would like to do which kind of business, whether you want to like the way to make money for yourself, or you would like to do the social business and solve the problem of the world, or you do both. There's no restriction. You can do the both because, as I said, people are selfish at the same time selfless. So we have two instincts, two dimensions in us, and we can solve this by using both rather than using just one. So we can. So we'll have more options in future. When we have in the textbooks, we discuss that in the courses, we discuss that, and we have a specialized degrees for both of them.
Now, moving on to you, Dr. Yunus, what things have helped you get here? Is it, as you said, that every time you see a social problem, you dream up a business to fix it? Is it this entrepreneurial and creative mindset? Can you talk a little bit about these personal qualities that have helped you thus far?
I guess just to pay attention to the problems that you see around yourself and feel that I can do something about it, rather than get the feeling, oh, I have nothing to do about it, government should do that, it's not my business, it's too big anyway, I'm not capable of doing that. I think one has to come out of that kind of thinking process, always feeling that, yes, I can do something, and I have the capacity. I can, if I think hard enough, I can come up with an idea. Just because I have no idea right from the beginning doesn't mean that I cannot come up with an idea. So if I think hard enough, I can come up with an idea to solve the problem of not the whole world, but for 2 people, 5 people, 10 people. If I can solve the problem of 5 people, I can solve for the problem of 10 people, all by repeating the same thing. For example, if I want to get 5 people from social welfare, because many people in the States, for example, in many other countries, are on welfare. Once they get into welfare, they practically spend their lifetime in welfare. They cannot get out because there's no opportunity to get out. So I can think of creating a social business where these 5 people will find a very satisfactory income-generating activity for themselves, and they are enjoying their life. They don't want to go back to welfare and want to stay away from welfare because they can grow. They can now use their own talent, own capacity, own creativity, and enjoy being on their own. So if I have been successful in doing that as a business way, then I can repeat this to take another 5 and bring out 10 people in total out of this social welfare. Seeing me doing this, another person say, if you can do 5 people, 10 people come out of welfare, well, I can do better than that. I can go for 20 at a time. So he starts doing it for 20 at a time. And third, fourth people say, hey, this is easy. I can do that too. So if we, each one of us doing something, it adds up. It becomes a huge, huge, huge contribution in changing the whole status of welfare, because government saves the money, taxpayers don't have to pay for it, and the dignity of these people is restored because they are creative people, able people, somehow rejected from the system and kept in a corner, not knowing what their future will be like. So this is the kind of thought that I had in the beginning, that I must do something. And if I can make myself useful for one person, for one day, I thought my life will be done. I thought this is what I feel happy, that I've done something. I'm useful to one person, even for a day. So I made my ambition very small, just to use myself in a way that I'm of some help to one person, even for a day. So if I can do something for a day, I would like to do for 2 days, 3 days, 5 days, 10 days, and that began. If I can do it for one person for 1 year, then I would like to do for one person for another year. So this is how it all began. And microcredit started that way. I was not thinking of doing the microcredit all over the world. That was not my idea. I didn't even know that this is needed elsewhere. But I did it in the one village. I thought I can do it. So I'd lend money from my pocket. My loan was about $27 going to 42 people as loans. So that was nothing, insignificant. But I thought at least these 42 people are benefiting, and why not? I can do that. It's my ability, and I do that. So since they liked it, I wanted to repeat it. That's why I went to the bank to connect more people with the bank, and bank resisted it, and the rest of the history, that I offered myself as a guarantor and all that. Now microcredit has become a global phenomenon. We done microcredit not only in many countries, and many countries started microcredit programs on their own. We even now run microcredit program in the USA. We have a company called Grameen America. We run microcredit just like Grameen Bank in Bangladesh, in Jackson Heights in New York, in Brooklyn in New York, and in also in Harlem in New York. Also in Omaha, Nebraska. Now we are invited to do it in San Francisco, and also invited to do it in Washington, D.C., so and also Indianapolis. So many places are coming up. They would like to have that. The point I'm making that you don't have to think about doing a big, big thing globally. You start small, and if you're successful, then this can be repeated. All you're doing is developing a seed. The seed is the most important thing. Once you develop the seed, then you can multiply. You can have a whole plantation of those seeds, and the global plantation is the next step. It goes like that. So beginning with an idea that, yes, I have the capacity to change one person's life and make impact on one person's life in any way. It could be financial, it could be health-wise, it could be any way that I see people suffering.
With all the social and environmental problems facing the world today, what gets you going and excited to wake up every day and tackle some of these toughest issues? In your book, Creating a World Without Poverty, you discuss the confidence you have in the young generation. Is that one of the factors?
It's very exciting work. Every time you do something, it's creative work. When you are involved in a creative work, it has its own fascination. And then once you see that creative work you have done really impacted on people's lives, it's a very exciting experience. You can't stop doing that. It makes you feel so happy every time you do that. So the excitement of the work keeps you moving. It's not one that you get exhausted. When you don't like something, then you get exhausted very quickly. You are a singer or you're painter, you got the job of a banker, and you go to the bank and you do the treasury, you do the work because that's where you get your salary from. But you don't enjoy it. So when you get home, you're already very tired because your mind didn't pick up anything from that. But if it is something that you enjoy, if a painter is painting, he never gets tired because he loves what he does and he keeps doing it. And you can't stop him. If you say, okay, it's 5 o'clock, it's time to go. So why should I go? I'm working. I'm enjoying. So he wants to work. As the night comes, he still works. He said, oh, my God, you're working extra time. I said, no, I'm just enjoying myself. So that's the kind of thing. When you enjoy something and you want to go in many other directions because you see all the opportunities, all the avenues that you have not touched yet, and you want to go and try that, and you take the challenges, and you come up with ideas after ideas. And that's what happens, and this is what keeps you pushing.
Dr. Yunus, you're an inspiration to many people, including myself and millions all over the world. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to an interview in the Social Innovation Live series. This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Social Innovation, a department of the Stanford Graduate School of Business that educates leaders to solve the world's toughest social and environmental problems.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was Stephen Eng. Our website editor was Marguerite Rigoglioso. The series producer is Ashkan Jafari.
This is Chris Deigelmeyer
and Eric Nee on Social Innovation Conversations.
Thank you for listening.